The following is the WWE second quarter earnings conference call recorded on July 26, 2018.
I will now turn the call over to Michael White, Senior Vice President, Financial Planning and Investor Relations. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to WWE second quarter 2018 earnings conference call. Leading today's discussion are Vince McMahon, our Chairman and CEO, as well as George Barrios and Michelle Wilson, our co-presidents. Their remarks will be followed by a Q&A session. We issued our earnings release earlier this morning and have posted the release, our earnings presentation, and other supporting materials on our website, corporate.wwe.com/investors. Today's discussion will include forward-looking statements. These forward-looking statements reflect our current views, are based on various assumptions, and are subject to risks and uncertainties disclosed in our SEC filings. Actual results may differ materially, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. Additionally, the matters we will be discussing today may include non-GAAP financial measures. Reconciliation of non-GAAP to GAAP information is set forth in our earnings release and presentation, which are available on our website. Finally, as a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded, and the replay will be available on our website later today. At this time, it's my privilege to turn the call over to Vince.
Thanks. As you can obviously see, we delivered strong operating and financial performance during the quarter. We're, as a result, raising our guidance for the full year. Of note, we had two record-breaking live events within the quarter, WrestleMania, as everyone knows, it's our big annual event, and a new one, Greatest Royal Rumble, which was held in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Both are, that, by the way, was our largest international event ever in terms of gross. And all of you know as well, the future distribution of Raw and SmackDown in the U.S., we announced that with USA and USA Network and Fox Sports with an AAV of 3.6 times our original deal. Of note as well, some of the upcoming events, there's what we call Mae Young Classic, featuring 32 women from around the world. It's a tournament of sorts, and speaking of our female performers, we announced just the other day our first ever all women's pay-per-view, which is entitled WWE Evolution. That's on Sunday, October 28th. And there are a number of other new events, such as this, that we'll be announcing shortly. We are launching short-form content entitled, really, The Best of WWE Ever, how that would be translated in the following languages, in Spanish, Portuguese, German, and plan to produce WWE Now, which is similar to Best of WWE Now in Arabic. We're pleased with our performance, as said before, and we're on path to continue to achieve record revenue and record adjusted OIBDA and record subscribers. George, you want to take it?
Yep. Thanks, Vince. There are several key topics which we'd like to review today. These include management discussion of our business performance, progress of key strategic initiatives, and our business outlook. During the second quarter, we delivered strong financial performance as we capitalized on opportunities around the world. Particularly outside the U.S., our success was manifested in higher content rights fees, advertising and sponsorship sales, and network subscriptions. These factors generated a 79% increase in adjusted OIBDA to more than $43 million. Based on this positive momentum, our results exceeded our quarterly guidance. As Vince mentioned, supports us raising our full-year guidance, which I'll discuss further in a moment. But first, let's review our business performance in the quarter and turn to page 4 of our presentation, which shows the revenue, operating income, and adjusted OIBDA contribution by segment as compared to the prior year quarter.
So starting with our media segment, adjusted OIBDA increased $26.7 million based on a 48% or a $65.4 million increase in revenue. The revenue growth was driven by the distribution of new content in international markets, higher rights fees in our core content agreements, and continued growth of WWE Network. The significant monetization of new content was an integral component of the quarter's other media and advertising revenue. Average paid subscribers for WWE Network reached 1.8 million, increasing 10% from the prior quarter. In terms of adjusted OIBDA, increases in certain production costs and accrued management incentive compensation partially offset the growth in revenue. The increasing monetization of content, as evident in the second quarter, reflected some important operational achievements. During the quarter, we produced nearly 430 hours of content, monetized new opportunities across platforms, and worked to optimize our future distribution. As Vince mentioned, Monday Night Raw and SmackDown Live remain the highest rated programs on USA Network. We secured agreements with USA and Fox Sports effective October 2019 that increased the program's combined AAV, or average annual value, in the U.S. to 3.6 times that of our prior deal with NBCU. Extending our reach on television, we also delivered our third captivating season of Total Bellas. We developed a new, highly entertaining series, Ms. and Mrs., that just premiered this past Tuesday night on USA Network, and announced the eighth season return this September of our successful series, Total Divas. On our streaming service, WWE Network, pay-per-views and original programming continue to drive our viewer engagement. Some examples of our exciting new programming on the network included The Greatest Royal Rumble, emanating from Saudi Arabia, the UK Championship Tournament, and a new season of Camp WWE. To these, we also added more in-ring content with the announcement of our second women's tournament, as Vince mentioned, the Mae Young Classic, which will culminate with the finale at our first ever women's pay-per-view event, WWE Evolution, on Sunday, October 28th. On social and digital platforms, consumption of WWE content increased dramatically. Through the first 6 months of the year, digital video views increased 58% to 14.4 billion, and our fans watched nearly 510 million hours of content, representing a 71% increase from the first half of last year. Contributing to this growth, we produced more than 165 hours of social and digital content, including versions of the Best of WWE series in Spanish, Portuguese, and German, and we also plan to launch a new series, again, as Vince mentioned, WWE Now, which will be in Arabic. As evidenced by our programs during the quarter, we are becoming more digital, direct-to-consumer, and more global every day.
Looking at our other segments, adjusted OIBDA from our live events, as shown on page 6 of the presentation, declined $3 million, primarily due to a reduction in ticket sales and an increase in production costs. Ticket sales at North American events were impacted by the staging of five fewer events in the quarter and an 8% decline in average attendance. Live events held in the quarter were highlighted by the staging of two record-breaking events, WrestleMania and the Greatest Royal Rumble. Building on the successful execution of these large-scale events, we announced WWE Super Showdown, an event to be held in Australia that will feature the largest roster of WWE superstars to appear in that country. Adjusted OIBDA from consumer products was essentially unchanged from the prior year quarter. During the quarter, we continued to develop new licensing partnerships and to expand the presence of WWE among children. Contributing to this result, we continue to increase the penetration of our mobile games. As of quarter end, we had more than 90 million installs across our game portfolio, led by WWE Champions and WWE Supercard, as well as our newest game, WWE Mayhem, which recently surpassed 12 million installs. Page 8 of the presentation shows selected elements of our cap structure. As of June 30th, 2018, we held approximately $340 million in cash and short-term investments. Additionally, we estimate that WWE has approximately $100 million in debt capacity under the company's revolving credit facility. We generated $64.6 million in free cash flows compared to $1.3 million in the prior year period, with growth primarily due to strong operating performance and timing in working capital. Earlier this year, we discussed a step up in capital expenditures in 2018 to build out our video production infrastructure to support the company's growth. We have decided to delay that spending as our plans continue to evolve. Therefore, for 2018, we now anticipate capital expenditures of $30 to $40 million, which is roughly in line with our historical average of approximately 5% of revenue. We do expect to finalize our plans for the build-out I referenced later this year, and we'll provide further guidance at that time. As we indicated during our call on June 27th, we expect to provide additional long-term perspective regarding WWE's strategic, operating, and financial goals after we complete our distribution plans in our remaining markets. As a reminder, we expect to reach agreement regarding distribution in the UK by year-end 2018 and in India in the first half of 2019. In the first half of 2018, we've achieved a 59% increase in adjusted OIBDA to $78.7 million. In the second half of 2018, we expect adjusted OIBDA to remain relatively flat year over year. This includes projected third quarter adjusted OIBDA of $30 to $34 million, and then strong fourth quarter results. Based on our actual and projected performance, we're now raising our target for 2018 adjusted OIBDA to a range of $160 million to $170 million, which of course would be an all-time record and exceed our previous guidance of at least $150 million. This guidance for the second half of 2018 assumes a continued rise in revenue, increases in core fixed costs, additional strategic investments, and higher management incentive compensation based on 2018 overperformance. In addition to these items, projected third quarter results also reflect the timing impact of various initiatives. In the third quarter, we also estimate average paid subscribers of approximately 1.67 million, representing an approximate 10% increase from the prior year quarter. Finally, in the fourth quarter, we anticipate meaningful revenue growth based on the escalation of content rights fees, favorable timing of licensing revenue associated with the implementation of the new FASB standard, which we previously discussed. As I have said before, our key strategic goals over the remainder of the year remain unchanged. Finalizing the global distribution plans for Raw and SmackDown, creating new content across all platforms, investing in the ongoing digitization of WWE, primarily in data and our product technology, and driving international growth. We believe this strategy will engage our global fans in more ways than ever before. And this part's very important. By strengthening this engagement, we deepen the moat around our business, enabling us to focus on the significant opportunities in front of us. And these opportunities are predicated on several global trends that include the escalating consumption of video across direct-to-consumer, digital, and social platforms, the increasing demand for premium, live, branded content by all media companies, and the growing middle class in key developing markets. Our execution, coupled with these trends, creates a foundation for sustainable long-term growth and increases in shareholder value. That concludes this portion of our call, and I'll now turn it back to Michael.
Thank you, George. Lisa, we're ready. Please open the line for questions.
Thank you, sir. As a reminder, everyone, if you'd like to ask a question, it's star one on your telephone keypad. Also, if you are on a speakerphone, please make sure your mute option is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is star one. We'll take our first question from Curry Baker with Guggenheim Securities.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for the questions. I have two. The first is the Saudi Arabia partnerships appeared to have a big impact on results this quarter. Can you maybe share some more color on the financial impact around that deal in the quarter, your satisfaction thus far, especially with the Jeddah event, and maybe give us some color about how to think about the partnership going forward, and I guess what's the ultimate opportunity there, and what's next on the horizon for the Saudi partnership?
Yeah, so in the first part, in a lot of our agreements, we have confidentiality clauses, so we're not going to speak to the specifics any more than what were in the prepared remarks. It's in our earnings release and in the queue. I will give kind of a broader conceptual framework. For the last 10 years or so, we've been talking about investing in data to understand our consumers, our fans better. We've talked about investing in video across all platforms, especially an increase in the amount of video we produce for the digital and social platforms. And we've also talked about investing in our focus on international markets, whether it's people on the ground or people here across all our functions, focus on that opportunity. Because of all of that, The return is based on us being able to monetize the brand, sometimes in ways we see while we're making the investments and sometimes in new and unique ways. And I've characterized the partnership with the GSA in Saudi Arabia as one of those. And as we mentioned, it's a 10-year partnership. It'll include a major event like we just did, the timing of which we're still working through.
Okay, thanks. And secondly, the third quarter OIBDA outlook was softer than we had forecast. Can you maybe walk us through in detail what is driving the unfavorable timing and maybe what the business initiatives are that you flagged as a drag on the third quarter?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned, I think it's important to look at the back half in total, which we think is relatively flat year over year for the reasons we mentioned. Core fixed cost growth year over year has a tough comp. We had reduced those costs last year in the fourth quarter because we wanted to make sure we met the targets we set for ourselves last year. So you're seeing kind of just core fixed costs get back to a normal level. We're going to continue to invest in the business for the long term. And then the specific on the third and fourth quarter on the timing, there's some things that we've moved from a year over year basis, initiatives that we had in the fourth quarter last year, or investments we made that we moved up forward to the third quarter. There's some differences in timing on the routing of events. So there's a couple of things between the two quarters that causes the third quarter to be a little softer and the fourth quarter again to show significant growth. So we'll talk about more details when we report.
Okay, thanks, George.
We'll take our next question from Ben Swinburne with Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good morning. Two questions. One, I think, tied to the last one, which is just to look at this other revenue growth in the quarter. You had $60 million of other in media, up from $11 or $12 million last year. I know you're not going into details on specific contracts, but could you at least help us understand, George, kind of the revenue recognition policies that are driving when you realize revenues in these kind of agreements and whether or not we should be thinking about this as a recurring benefit over time and any color on sort of how that business works as it flows through your financials. And then maybe a more interesting question, hopefully. You guys talked about a 60% increase in digital views, 70% increase in hours viewed during the quarter. I presume those are global statistics. Do you guys think you're producing as much content as there is demand? I guess what I'm asking is, do you see big opportunity to ramp up production given what you're seeing out there in terms of global demand for your content? And if you do, is the organization scaled from an infrastructure and people and systems perspective to sort of ramp that up a lot and meet that demand? Because you're certainly going to have the money starting next year to do it. So I'm just curious how you think about the supply-demand dynamic around content.
Yeah, there's a broader discussion of putting the investments we're going to make on the returns we think we're going to achieve, and we want to do that at a later time when we've locked down some of the other still open items, kind of give a broad perspective for WWE and put the model around it, the business model. But there is no doubt that we are nowhere near reaching the limit of the amount of content that we can create and the amount of engagement that we can drive. When you look at the numbers, we'll do close to 1 billion hours of consumption across the digital platforms, not including the network, so above 1 billion when you put the direct-to-consumer network. That number we think we can keep growing, and we can keep growing with new content as well as localizing that content, more languages, more locally produce content. So we just think the opportunity is enormous. As you know, Ben, you write about it, this is all a fight for time. We're all fighting for time. And so the more we can engage fans, the more ways we can entertain them, the more time we can take. So yeah, and as far as do we have the resources, we're going to continue to invest for the long term. We think this is a 10 plus year runway. If you believe in the global trends we mentioned, if you believe in those, then you believe in the investment, we're going to keep doing that. And again, we'll size what we think those investments are at some point in the future. But similar to the success we're seeing today, is because the investments we made over the last 10 years, we think the success we'll see 10 years from now is going to be driven by the investments we make today. So that's how we view the world. I think on the rev rec question, the less interesting one, the deal in Saudi Arabia is unique. So you see the economics presented in in the live event segment, in the media segment, across advertising and sponsorship, and as you rightfully mentioned, what we categorize as other. Now, other includes, in addition to revenue related to the Saudi Arabian event, also includes Divas, it includes Bellas. That's what we characterize. It's in essence the non-Raw and SmackDown rights, because those are kind of unique agreements. So that's the rev rec. I'd say the predominant amount for the Saudi Arabian event is in other, but we're not going to talk about how much. And it is a recurring. It's a 10-year deal, and so it will be recurring. The timing, when in the year it will happen, still to be determined. And again, the timing of the event is what triggers the rev rec across all the line items I mentioned. For the most part, there's some delay because of some of the rights, but the predominant economics are in the second quarter.
That's very helpful. Thank you, George.
We'll take our next question from Eric Katz with Wells Fargo.
Good morning, everyone. I guess just following up on the Saudi question, you mentioned another potentially big event in Australia. I'm just kind of wondering, size-wise, you mentioned the largest amount of superstars to appear in that country. Is this a similar type of deal? Are you looking to pursue Saudi-type deals throughout the rest of the world at this point?
Yeah, I think, look, on the are we looking to pursue Saudi-type deals? What we're looking, and it's different market by market, is win the battle for time. If you do that, you're going to find ways to monetize the brand. In some ways, we have a clear path of what that is. In others, I think we're going to be surprised. But the first thing is win the battle for time, and then we think the monetization opportunities will present themselves. Specifically on the Australian event, we're incredibly excited. We're going to absolutely thrill our Australian fans. But the deal is very different than the GSA deal. Again, but we won't get specific into the economics.
Okay. And then on the decision to pull back on CapEx spending, does that have any short-term impacts on growth expectations? And I'm not sure maybe it would be helpful to maybe describe the original plan there a bit more, if you're willing to.
Yeah, I mean, we had mentioned that we purchased a building here in Stamford near our current video production facility. Because we needed the capacity. I mean, today, and I think you've seen the footprint, Eric, we're spread around the city of Stamford. In some cases, actually have temporary facilities produce the video. So we were going to do the build out for that facility. Had been planned a significant portion of that to happen this year. We've delayed it because we're evaluating those plans. Obviously, the opportunities in front of us are incredible. We, as Ben mentioned, the cash flow profile of the company will change starting the fourth quarter next year. So we're just trying to marry those two facts and come up with the plan that we think best drives long-term value for us. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have solidified those plans and then we can talk about it. But if you mention, you know, historically we've done about 4 to 5% of revenue in CapEx. We've had a high of around 10 or 11% of revenue, a low of about 3% of revenue at the beginning of the year. We said we're probably going to be at the upper end of that range. Turns out for 18, we're actually going to be right dead on in the middle of the range or the average. But at some point here in the future, I'd expect we'd have a year or two, we'd be up at the upper end of the range.
Sure. And just one last, I guess, another boring one, if you don't mind. Can you remind us again of the FASB impact on Q4? Thank you.
Yeah, is that, if you remember, we're talking about the revenue recognition from our licensing business, which we used to record, in essence, on a lag from when the consumer transactions were happening. We'd wait till we received a statement from our partners like Mattel or Take-Two. Now we're making estimates during the period when the consumer transaction is happening. So where last year you would have seen the primary consumer licensing revenue hit in Q1. This year will be in Q4, and we talked about that impact in Q1 that was around $8 million of OIBDA. So it's that timing.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from David Karnofsky with JP Morgan.
All right, thank you. For the NXT rollout in the UK, can you talk about why now is the right time to introduce the brand there? And with the expansion of NXT into the region, does this impact at all how you're thinking about your television distribution within that country?
So I'll take that one, David. So on the UK tournament, why now? I think you know from the prior earnings call that we've had and information we've put out, we actually did the UK tournament previously a year ago, and we saw tremendous results. So it's not surprising that we repeated that from an engagement perspective on the network. It was a great success for us. So as we looked at that as an opportunity, similarly with the Mae Young Classic, the all-women's tournament, those tournaments are driving engagement on our network, obviously helping with retention and attracting new subscribers. So again, we just are continuing that plan. So it's not really coming out of the blue per se to repeat the UK tournament. What I'll say as far as our long-term view on that, and George mentioned this as we talked about, you know, the ability to continue to create content and is there demand. When we talk about localized content, we absolutely see that as a long-term opportunity for us around the world. And the UK tournament is a perfect example or manifestation of that localized content. And we believe our ability to tap into local talent and the interest within that marketplace just deepens our engagement with those fans. So again, we expect to do more of that moving forward. And that's just kind of the first step in terms of a UK tournament. So again, part of our overall strategy, Vince mentioned that we're creating some short form content in local language. So again, there's just great opportunity for us to continue to do that. So the time is now and will continue to be for the next 10 years, as George mentioned, on our international opportunities is to do more content that is localized for that market.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
It was just that whether the rollout of NXT there impacts at all how you're thinking about television distribution for the UK renewal.
Not necessarily.
Okay. And then I didn't see anything in the release on 2019. Are you still comfortable with the guide you provided at the end of June?
Yeah, we didn't put anything because it hasn't changed yet. So we're still committed to delivering over $200 million of adjusted OIBDA.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from Laura Martin with Needham. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Maybe a couple things. So can we talk about churn? You guys have gotten really good at predicting your OTT subs. Are you getting better at keeping the subs? Are you getting better at attracting subs? Where do you think, what's happening with churn in these OTT numbers?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, Laura, any subscription business, most important metric is retention. So the average kind of trailing 12 months continues to improve. Obviously, our churn is seasonal because of the large events, especially WrestleMania. So you get bumps in there, but trailing 12 months, we continue to improve. But I will say it's probably something Vince, Michelle, and I are never happy with that number. And as anyone who runs a subscription business says, you always wonder why isn't it 100% retention. But it keeps improving. But we're committed to getting the retention even better.
Okay. And then looking at the, so following up on something Vince said early on that you had two of the largest live events you've ever had, WrestleMania, which set records, and then Saudi Arabia. But I'm looking here at the live attendance averages, and they're falling. And even in 18, second quarter and first quarter, they're down year over year for the last 2 years. Is that because of our mix shift towards the next or why, or is it cannibalistic with the over-the-top network? I would have thought live events was complementary with the over-the-top network gaining like prominence. But why would our live event averages be falling, do you think?
Yeah, well, in essence, in North America, it's primarily venue mix. So depending on which venues we work in quarter over quarter, it's different venues. So you're going to get a little bit of a mix. So for us, we think over the trailing 12 months, if you look at it, North American attendance, it's relatively flat. And frankly, it's been that way. So we both our utilization, the average attendance, has been pretty consistent. So it isn't a mix. We don't include the NXT numbers because the event profile there and the attendance profile is very different. So we think from a external perspective to see the trend, it's better to not include those numbers. So NXT has nothing to do with it. So nothing strategic. I would say it's more tactical depending on which venues. And similarly, when we our international events, it also depends what countries we play in. It's not the same country profile year over year, which is why I always look at it and encourage investors to look at it this way, is trailing 12 months where you kind of can wash some of the quarterly changes out. And from that perspective, there's really no change.
Okay. And do you, just sort of big picture, do you think the OTT network helps your live performance, or do you think it cannibalizes because people can stay home and watch the same stuff?
No, we absolutely think it helps. It even, you know, it helps in the marketing of them. So, for example, because we have in the U.S. DMA data of viewership and what people are viewing on the network, we can kind of hone the marketing message when we market digitally to our fans. As an example, when we launched NXT and we're touring outside of Florida and we're trying to decide, because we've never done it before, what markets we should go into, we use the network data of NXT viewership to kind of select the market. So, yeah, we definitely don't think it's cannibalistic to the live event experience.
Okay. And then I'm writing a lot myself about the international sub-profile, profitability profile and growth. Do you think there's any reason that international subs cannot have the same margin profile as in the U.S. over the long term?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the model today, there's really no different on the margin profile, right? There's a level of fixed, because it's a U.S. product only. So we're creating the content, and then we're attracting subscribers. So whether a subscriber comes from Germany, the U.K., or any other country, the U.S., the economic profile is still the same. It's 80% or so variable margins on the incremental sub, so that doesn't matter. We've said that in the future, we'd like to localize the product, and have talked about Spanish language, German, potentially Hindi, and we're working through those plans. At that point, there'll be some incremental fixed costs, not material, but there's some incremental fixed costs around both the product and the technology. To localize the actual physical product and then localize the video. So at that point, you'd have a slightly different margin, but not materially different.
Okay, super helpful. Thanks so much for your help. Great numbers. Congratulations on a great quarter, you guys.
Our next question comes from Vasily Kerizyov with Cannonball Research.
Thank you. Good morning. Just wanted to try and size up the impact on EBITDA of this spike in revenue in media and other this, what you call in the press release, distribution of certain programming content in international markets. You already said that it's going to recur again next year, not clear what quarter, but my math says that it's around 30 to 35% EBITDA margin. Can you please say if I'm in the ballpark? And the second question I had is, you touched on it a little bit, but you mentioned that one of the investment areas for you is data. Can you maybe talk more beyond just targeting events, what you just mentioned? In what ways can a company like yours benefit from data going forward? Thank you.
Sure. On the first one, the margins are higher than the ones you mentioned. Again, we're not going to get specific around them, but they are higher than what you mentioned. And for us, for any direct-to-consumer business, and again, we have both a video service direct-to-consumer. We market our live event business, especially domestically, direct-to-consumer, because most of the purchases are done online. And then we have a large and what has been a fast-growing commerce business, e-commerce business around consumer products, direct-to-consumer. So around that, understanding the data of what people like, what superstars they're favoriting, that helps us tailor the marketing message. It also allows us to create bundles where it makes sense. We do a lot of analysis on what people are watching on YouTube, on the network, on Facebook, on our own and operated. That data gets circulated internally so people understand what's really driving the engagement. So it's a myriad of places throughout the organization. But as we continue to grow the number of user accounts that we have, the theory is the better you know them, the more smiles you can put on their faces, the greater the monetization opportunity. That's in essence the flywheel.
Would you ever sell the data to a third party?
We use the data to put smiles on people's faces. That's it. So if we can entertain them, that's what we're using the data to. So similar to how Netflix uses it. They learn about their consumers, create programming that will cause their fans to spend more time on their platform. That's what we do.
All right. Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Eric Handler with MKM Partners.
Yes, thank you very much, and good morning. Question maybe for some of the talent guys or people in the room. Just curious, we're now entering year two of sort of the build-out for the WWE UK brand. How far in the future do you think we are before we take that WWE UK brand and as we look to build out the WWE network throughout all of Europe, we take that WWE UK brand and morph it into a WWE Europe brand?
So, you know, it's a great question. And again, I think that, as I mentioned previously to David's question, that our investment in localizing content will continue to be a priority. So in terms of the timeline, I think it's going to continue to be a priority for us. You know, how we distribute that content, the marketplace will determine, and we'll get more intel on that moving forward. So again, from a talent development perspective, one of the things that we've also talked about is we have a very successful performance center that we have in Orlando, and Paul Levesque has done a tremendous job building our pipeline for talent. Interestingly, if you look at the data there, and as George mentioned, everything we do involves data now, about 44 to 45% of the talent that are now in our pipeline are coming from outside of the United States. So naturally, the question becomes, as we're creating local content, is there an opportunity for us to replicate what we're doing around the world and creating and generating not only our pipeline of talent within a region, but how do you then take content and create content around that that we then can monetize? So as we're kind of looking future and how we continue to build out that model that we're currently doing here in the U.S., something that we're looking at and will be part of our plans moving forward. So again, you know, expected, you know, that to be part of what you'll hear moving forward.
Okay, and then, you know, as we talk about customization for, you know, with all the data and all the investments you've made, at what point, how far away are you with the WWE Network to so that when people log on, there's a much more customizable homepage?
It's coming soon to a theater near you, but we're not going to make any announcements right now.
Stay tuned.
All right, you guys are no fun. All right, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Daniel Moore with the CJS Securities.
Thank you. Good morning. Following the strong contract renewals and as we look toward the exceptional inflection in cash flow in 2020 and beyond, I know you're not going to talk specifics in terms of numbers, but I guess generally, what types of investments, growth initiatives are you considering? Are there any that maybe, you know, weren't feasible in the past, or is it kind of more of the same? And what financial metrics, ROC guidelines, governors should we be thinking about in terms of incremental investments? Thank you.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we were looking at some old material that we had shared with the board probably 7 or 8 years ago, about the investments we were making then and we're going to continue to make and what we thought we could do in terms of raising the peak to trough earning and cash flow profile of the business. And it turned out that those investments over-delivered. We thought we could maybe double, close to triple those numbers. And as people have surmised, given the success we recently had, we'll probably go beyond that. And at that time, we were, you know, 60 to 75 million of OIBDA. So as we look to the future, we're doing the same kind of work, Dan, is thinking, what's the size of the opportunity? What do we think we need to go capture our unfair share? And then what do we think that drives in terms of shareholder value? And to your point, we'll be a little bit more fulsome once we have some remaining items behind us. But that's kind of the lens we use. We don't always have a clear line of sight to what the opportunity will be, but what's the size of the opportunity? You know, you take a country like India, what do we think GDP looks like 10 years from now? What do we think the M&E sector in India, therefore, looks like 10 years from now? Given how many smiles we're putting on people's faces there, what do we think our kind of unfair share of that is, and therefore, how much should we be investing? That's the process. Again, we're not going to put all the numbers to it today, but that's the process we use. As opposed to the types of investments, I don't think I'd characterize it more of the same, But yeah, we're going to continue to invest in our digital products. We're going to continue to invest on creating more content across every platform, traditional, digital, and direct-to-consumer. Michelle mentioned we're going to do it in more languages across all those platforms. So in some way, I guess you could say more of the same, but I think the depth and breadth will be different. Something like expanding the performance center model globally that allows us to not only increase the talent pipeline, but create actual indigenous local content with local source, we think is an amazing opportunity. It's a 10 to 20 year opportunity for us to take advantage. So we'll do that. And yeah, that's probably an example of something we might have had to do at a much slower pace if not for the success we've had.
That is actually very, very good color. Congrats. Appreciate it.
As a reminder, everyone, that is star one to ask a question. We'll take our next question from Jason Bazinet with Citi.
Just had a quick question on international. If I look back 2007 to 2017, about 25% of your revenues came, I think, from outside the U.S., you know, bounced around a little bit, but not a lot of change. When you guys think about this 45% of your talent pipeline coming from outside the U.S. and then begin to adjust for things like GDP per capita and the like, what do you think a reasonable mix is for a company like yours that's focused on international?
Yeah, I look, the way we look at it is the way you just said it. I mean, GDP per capita is ultimately the M&E sector globally tends to be a percentage of the GDP and or the GDP per capita, however you want to look at it. So I always tell people, if you want to really think about the opportunity for WWE, think about what's the total market, what percentage of the consumption we're getting. Those things should help you size what the opportunities for WWE is, how we think of the U.S. market, frankly. So in terms of mix, I'm not going to put a number on it, but I think if you say 20 years from now, do you think the M&E sector has grown faster outside the U.S. than the U.S.? I think so, because you have countries like India and China whose GDP and therefore M&E sector is growing. So our job is to, you know, and it sounds trite, but it really is what we do, is put smiles on those faces. If we do that, then we should get an unfair share, but we've got to do that. That's hard work.
Okay, maybe one quick follow-up. As you look at the consumption data that's very robust, is your intuition that the right answer is to double down on the markets where you are internationally, or is the right answer to expand into more geographies?
Yeah, there's very few geographies that we're not in. In fact, if you're looking at digital and social, there's none. You know, if someone has a broadband connection in that country, we're there in that market. In some markets, we're more invested than in others. But if you said, do we need to get into a new market? Probably not. Do we need to go deeper in some of these big opportunities? Yes, we definitely do.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Alan Wu for TSC News. Thanks so much for tuning in to this WWE Quarterly Earnings Conference Call Postmortem. Make sure to subscribe to TSC News so you can get updates on future conference calls like this and those at the UFC.